Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with Linda Greenhouse, Pulitzer Prize-winning Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times for 30 years. We're going to talk about her latest book, Justice on the Brink, The Death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, The Rise of Amy Coney Barrett, and 12 Months That Transformed the Supreme Court. And you can learn more about Linda's work at, I'm going to give you two websites, law.yale.edu/Linda-Greenhouse. law.yale.edu/Linda-Greenhouse. And nytimes.com/buy/Linda-Greenhouse. So on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to politics, media, economics, environment, science, health, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Podomatic.com, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net. TerrenceMcNally.net. So, what has happened to the Supreme Court? Remember, this is nine justices with lifetime appointments. And when five of these nine unelected individuals decide something, their five votes count more than either of the other branches, more than the president's or those of all legislators combined, and more than the millions who elected all of them. The makeup of the current Supreme Court is the achieved goal of a decades-long project on the right and in the Republican Party. Now, there's no denying that its success, the success of that project, owes something to timing and luck. The U.S. holds only one national popular vote, that for president and vice president. And the Republican Party has won that national vote only once since 1988. That's 32 years. Think about that. Yet they have held the presidency 12 of those years and have held Senate majorities for many of those years, though often receiving millions of fewer votes than the Democrats in Senate elections. As a result, they dominate the Supreme Court. Since Nixon, Republicans have appointed 15 justices, Democrats 4. Okay, you want to start at Reagan? It's 11-4. And even since that 1988 election of Bush, it's 7-4. I mean, a president who lost the popular vote can nominate a justice who is confirmed by a Senate that represents a minority of the population. Brett Kavanaugh, nominated by a president who lost the popular vote and confirmed by senators representing only 44% of the U.S. population. As Matthew Iglesias wrote on Vox.com, control of the courts allows Republicans to further tilt the electoral playing field, and waging judicial politics on a tilted playing field allows Republicans to control the courts. In my lifetime, the balance of conservatives and more progressive judges has moved back and forth. We've tended to refer to them by the party of the president who appointed them, but many aspects of this current court feel beyond anything else I've seen. Nothing makes it clearer that the court has been politicized than Mitch McConnell's refusal to consider Merrick Garland and his contradictory and unseemly rush to confirm Amy Coney Barrett. Today's court, I believe, is a powerful and long-lasting tool of minority rule, removing limits to money and dark money in elections through Citizens United, eliminating Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, the refusal to rule on partisan gerrymandering, the elevation of religious preference over other civil rights, overwhelmingly deciding for business over individuals. All of these, I sense, overrule the desires of the majority of Americans. Now, I confess, by the way, that this is not always bad, that the court overrule the majority. Brown versus Board of Education may not have been the policy of the majority in 1954. But I also believe that sustained minority rule not only produces and prolongs unpopular policies, but also weakens and sickens democracy breeding cynicism, resignation, and the sorts of tribal divisions that we now face. 2 days after the 2020 election, Linda Greenhouse wrote, "We may not yet know who won the presidential election, but everyone knows that the Supreme Court now has a conservative 6-3 majority, and that the Senate's Republican majority's hardball tactics, driven by blatant cynicism, achieved that result during an amazingly compressed period of not even 6 weeks. From Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death in mid-September until Justice Amy Coney Barrett's installation a week before Election Day." Greenhouse then set out to write a book detailing the decisions and the underlying strategies of the court's latest term, the first for Coney Barrett and that 6-3 majority. In the book, Greenhouse explores a broad range of issues that confronted the court in the 2020-21 term, questions arising out of the 2020 presidential election, the death penalty, COVID and its impact on worship services, the demands of individuals sentenced to death for the presence of religious representatives of their choice, the Affordable Care Act, the constitutionality of various voting accommodations related to COVID, search and seizure, Second Amendment, and fundamental issues involving the meaning of the free exercise of religion. Linda Greenhouse, winner of the 1998 Pulitzer Prize, reported in the Supreme Court for the New York Times from 1978 to 2008, and now writes for the Times on alternate Thursdays about the Supreme Court and the law. She also teaches at Yale Law School. Her books include The U.S. Supreme Court, A Very Short Introduction, Becoming Justice Blackmun, The Burger Court and the Rise of the Judicial Right, written with Michael J. Graetz, the memoir, Just a Journalist, and her latest, the one we'll be talking about today, Justice on the Brink, The Death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, The Rise of Amy Coney Barrett, 12 Months That Transformed the Supreme Court. Welcome again, Linda Greenhouse, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Well, thank you, Terry. I mean, your intro made me want to kind of hide under my bed, but yeah.
How dark it all sounds.
Yeah, boy. But that's the truth. That is the truth. I mean, one question, of course, is the court the product of our problems or the cause of our problems? I guess it's a little bit of both.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, and that whole thing of how they feed on each other is, I think, what we really need to face. And this whole thing of lifetime appointments, my God. Let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Monday, November 29th. Now, Linda, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So could you tell us a bit about how you see at this point your path to your career and, in fact, the work you do today, and feel free to go way back, mentors, turning points, moments of decision?
Yeah, sure. I mean, when I have visitors to my class at Yale Law School, and I've had Merrick Garland, Don Verrilli, who was the Solicitor General for President Obama for close to 8 years. I always ask them exactly what you just asked me.
Excellent.
Because, I find that students today think, you pick a path and you stay on the path and everything is going to flow from that. And for most of us, I'm guessing for you as well, that's simply not true. Life is full of serendipity, of roads not taken, of unexpected roads that open up. And that was certainly the case for me. I mean, I've always been interested in journalism. I think I've always said and told myself, and I think this is true, that what really got my attention was Theodore White's great path-breaking book, The Making of the President, 1960.
I must say, can I cut in for 1 second? And I must say that is also true for me. And you may well know this, but Doris Kearns Goodwin says exactly the same thing.
No, really? I thought it was so original.
No. The three of us, by the way, are within a few years of each other.
Well, right. So I was 13 at the time of the 1960 election. I had a wild movie star crush on JFK. So, of course, I read the book and I thought, oh my gosh, these people are being paid, the reporters are being paid to fly around the country with this man who, I have this wild crush on. And wow, is that something that people can actually do for a living? So, you know, that piqued my interest. And I did, you know, the usual journalism in high school. I was editor of my high school paper. I went to college at Radcliffe, which was at the time the women's auxiliary of Harvard University. All the classes were co-ed and the activities were co-ed, but Radcliffe in those days had a separate kind of corporate identity. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I went out for the Crimson, Harvard Crimson, which is the undergraduate college newspaper. Men and women both could write for the Crimson. I was the only female freshman who had the nerve to actually enter the competition to get on the paper and stuck it out. So I got on the paper.
Wow. I mean, I'm surprised, actually. But I know that it was at that time, because we overlap, as I say. I graduated in 69 and you in
68,
right. That I knew that the Crimson was, you know, finally having women. I didn't realize that, as you say, only one even applied your freshman year. Wow.
It was pretty intimidating. It was really, really, you know, it really shaped my college experience. And then the question was, what was I going to do for like a living? I had been the Boston Herald Harvard Stringer, where they paid me for, you know, writing stories about all the anti-war activities and all the ferment about that was going on at Harvard in those times. And they paid me and so on, printed my stories. And when I applied to them for a job after graduate, you know, as graduation was approaching, I couldn't even get an interview.
Oh, my God.
They didn't have women in the newsroom. Neither did the Boston Globe. Neither did practically anybody, actually. But I had heard about, through the Harvard network, a job at the New York Times. James Reston, who in his day was probably the most famous, one of the most famous political columnists, he had modeled a kind of personal internship program after a Supreme Court clerkship. So I applied. He had never hired a woman. But he had hired a couple of guys who got drafted because the Vietnam draft was on. So that wasn't going to be a problem if he hired me. And so it was a job that lasted a year, gave me a chance to write. I got stories printed in the paper and elsewhere, and then got a staff tryout and stayed at the paper for the next close to 40 years. Doing a variety of things. It never really occurred to me in those years that I would end up spending the bulk of my career writing about the U.S. Supreme Court, because I had chosen not to go to law school. Not that I had anything against law school. Many of my Crimson friends went to law school. But I really wanted to be out in the world of work, so I had not pursued that, although it interested me. Mm-hmm. In fact, one day when I was kind of bored at work, I remember calling up the Southern District of New York, the federal court, and I said, I'd like to volunteer for jury duty. and they said, we don't take volunteers. So, you know, I was interested. But I don't,
no one volunteers for jury duty. That's...
Well, I would actually love to be on a jury. I've never been on one.
Oh, my gosh.
But anyway, so I worked in a city desk. I worked in the suburbs. They sent me to Albany to cover the state legislature. I became the Albany bureau chief at a very young age. That was a great ride because it was the years of the New York City fiscal crisis. Mm. You probably remember.
Oh, yeah.
President Ford to New York, dropped dead. I mean, yeah. It was like high-stakes stuff.
And yeah.
Got me a lot of exposure, and I learned a great deal about politics, about municipal finance, and all kinds of stuff. And then I asked for a transfer to Washington, thinking that that was a logical next step to cover Congress or maybe the White House. And they actually needed somebody at the court. And they said, how about a new fellowship has just opened up at Yale Law School, funded by the Ford Foundation, in the belief that we need better educated reporters in the newsrooms of America who are literate about law. So I went to Yale for a year and did basically a terminal first year law school. In other words, all the required courses and a bunch of electives and got a master's degree and went down to Washington and started writing about the court. This was 1978. And I just kept doing it until they offered a lucrative buyout in 2008. And I judged correctly that there was never going to be such a lucrative offer on the table again. So I put my hand up and to my then surprise, was offered a full-time teaching job at Yale Law School. So I said yes to that as well. And that's the deal. So I'm, you know, kind of gradually phasing out my teaching career. I'm just teaching one course a semester now instead of full-time. So I have more time to do other things. But I have to say, it's been an unexpected and pretty great ride.
Wow. Let me say two things. One, the point that you made, that you asked this question of your guests, and they always break the expectation of a straight line, right? I ask this question almost every time, and this would now be 25 years. And that is exactly the same thing. This idea that you get a goal, you know, as a teenager or in college, and you just stick your nose on that and go, is not what happens in so many fields, so many different fields. It's the happy accidents. And I mean, just as you told that story, the fact that Reston had a fellowship, that you can't get a job in Boston, but you can get a job with the Times, that Yale has a fellowship just at that moment, and you get a law school education in 1 year. It's wonderful, the accidents you happen to bump into.
Well, and I'll say one more thing also, that, you know, I'm really a beneficiary of the women's movement. I was a little too young to, you know, kind of be a mover and shaker in the second wave feminism that took place in the late 60s, early 70s, but there was a sex discrimination lawsuit against the New York Times in the early 1970s, as there was against, a more famous one was against Newsweek. This is going on all over the place. And so the lawyer who was representing the women, the plaintiffs, was a law professor at Columbia named Harriet Rapp. Actually, the first woman I ever met who was a lawyer, if you can believe it. And she had her law students go around and interview all the women, saying, you know, what would you like to do? What's your goal here at the Times? So there weren't that many of us, so that was not like a really heavy lift. And I kind of had looked around, and I had discerned that a really good career path at the Times seemed to include some time in Albany covering the legislature and the governor. The Times had never sent a woman to the Albany Bureau, which kind of replicated the Harvard Crimson in its completely macho frat boy atmosphere, I have to say. So I said, I'd like to go to Albany. And lo and behold, they sent me to Albany. So in a way, you know, I say to people, you know, I received affirmative action, right?
Yeah.
And I embrace affirmative action because all it meant was they gave me a chance, right? I could have screwed up, but, you know, I did a pretty good job. And so an opportunity like that is kind of what you make of it. And I'm grateful that I got the opportunity. I thank the women's movement for giving me that opportunity. And then, you know, what I made of it was up to me.
So let's turn to this book, and then we'll peel as many layers of the onion as we can in the time that remains. But how did this book, Justice on the Brink, happen? I last interviewed you in 2005 on Becoming Harry Blackmun. In a way, these books couldn't be more different. That's a period historical piece, you know, one justice, and you got, this is like, you know, today's news and moving quickly. How did this book happen? Why this book at this time? And maybe even, was there a moment when you said, I got to write this?
Well, to be perfectly honest, it wasn't my idea. It was the idea of a brilliant editor at Random House, whom I had never met, and I had never published with Random House, named David Ebershoff. And he, through my agent, got in touch with me and said, you know, something amazing is happening. The three Trump justices on the Supreme Court, this was around November, just about 13 months ago. He said, how would you like to write a book that would tell us about this unfolding year? And we would endeavor to publish it as soon as we could around the first Monday of October 2021, when the next term of the Supreme Court will be beginning. So my first thought, and I think I say this in the author's note, was, I can't do that. I'm not at the court. You know, it's a pandemic. I'm hiding right out in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts. But then I realized that nobody was at the court, because the court was closed to the public and the justices were conducting their business by telephone. So I was not at a disadvantage compared to the rest of the world. So I thought about it for about 5 minutes and I said, yeah, I'll do that. So, you know, when people ask me, well, how long did it take to write this book? I mean, the answer is 7 months and 40 years.
One thing that occurred to me, Linda, by the way, was that to someone who had only written long, well-researched books, the notion of putting something together this quickly, you know, as he told you, we plan to have it out in a year, would be pretty daunting. But you'd been meeting deadlines all your life.
Well, that's true. I mean, I really worked day and night because, as you saw in the book, it's not simply what was happening in real time, but it was what the background of why mm-hmm. it was happening, and you know, a lot of digging into the forces that produced what was unfolding during the year. So I basically worked day and night. I didn't. Yeah. I mean, the pandemic was helpful in that I wasn't going out. I wasn't giving dinner parties. I wasn't going to the movies. I don't think it could have been done by somebody leading what you might think of as a normal social life, let alone, you know, a career. And anyway, I found it kind of thrilling, actually. I mean, it was a heavy lift, but it kind of thrilled me to be able to channel everything I had learned in all those decades and get it down on paper in close to real time.
Yeah. And to turn in some sense the pandemic to your advantage. You know, I certainly saw that as soon as I started reading, was how this was both the court was affected by the pandemic, but also the time you had to write, the space you had to write, that all of that sort of thing, that the pandemic is an underlying foundation of the book.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, I always feel a little bit guilty because knowing, you know, of the death and dislocation and all the horrible things that have occurred during the pandemic, for me to say, you know, I had a pretty great pandemic, it feels very superficial and I'm a little embarrassed, but but objectively that's a fact.
I'm guessing, though, as we've just recounted, you wrote this book in real time, and you tell us a little bit how you decided to structure it, or maybe it was you and the agent in Powwow decided to structure it.
Well, no, I mean, they kind of left it up to me. It seemed to me the obvious way to do it would be month by month. So I actually started in the summer of 2020, before Ruth Ginsburg dies. And the first chapter is called The Triumph of John Roberts. Mm-hmm. So what did I mean by that? What I used that chapter to do was introduce Chief Justice Roberts, who had just come off, by his lights, had to have been a very, very successful term. He was in the majority in every important case. He kept the court out of trouble in the pandemic. He navigated everything very deftly and, you know, things were just looking great. That's July and into August. Then September, Ruth Ginsburg dies. And that changes everything. And you know, as I later learned, of course, I didn't know it at the time, that very night, Mitch McConnell reached President Trump, who was on Air Force One, returning from a campaign trip, and Mitch McConnell gave him two instructions. One, you're going to fill this vacancy before the election. And two, you're going to nominate Amy Coney Barrett.
Wow.
So then, you know, of course, I moved on to saying why Amy Coney Barrett and explaining why she was such an obvious choice. Her background, where she was placed, who she knew, what her network was, and so on. So that kind of drove that part of the narrative. And, you know, on it went into the pre-election, the post-election, and then into the heart of the term as they start actually deciding cases.
And I'm assuming that you had a pretty good idea where the story might well take you. In other words, the subtitle, The Death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, The Rise of Amy Coney Barrett, and 12 Months That Transformed the Supreme Court, sort of, you know, kind of tells us where the ride we're going to take. Were you surprised by the decisions where the court did not appear as, quote, transformed, as you might have foreseen, which, of course, just leaves us still on the brink?
Right, right. Well, I'll kind of reframe the question a bit.
Sure.
Because
yeah.
I think
I'm sure you've thought about this.
Yeah. I mean, there was one review of the book by a Harvard law professor who, to my kind of surprise, just didn't get it. Which is that a term of the Supreme Court is really a snapshot. Mm-hmm. And it builds on what came before, and it forecast what's going to come later. So two things that surprised me during the term are things that led people that, like this guy, didn't understand the court sufficiently to appreciate, really tell us how much had changed without yet changing anything. That is to say, the court has the ability to set its own agenda. And in setting its agenda, really sets our agenda as a country, politically, socially. So in the spring of 2021, this new court did two things. They agreed to hear the Mississippi abortion case, and they agreed to hear the New York State gun rights case. Two things that never would have happened had Amy Barrett not gone on the court and anchor a six-member conservative majority. That was transformative, just granting those two cases. And I could say more about that
let me go with where you're going right there. By the same token, the term that you write about, the 2021 term, those cases had already been chosen with the expectation, I'm assuming, that it would be a court that included Ginsburg and not one that included Barrett. So in the term you write about, the makeup was different than anticipated, and cases were chosen based on that makeup. But what I think you're revealing to people is that when the court decides what to even hear, there's strategy involved in that. And let me just, I'm going to lay out a big question here, because to me it was one of the things I learned from your book. One of the things that your book brought home to me was that in addition to major decisions that get mainstream media coverage, there are details, nuances in less celebrated opinions that you position within the agendas and the longer term projects, as you call them, of individual justices. Change on the Supreme Court often happens gradually, step by small step. Can you talk about that aspect of the court and cite a few examples from the book? We may come back later and talk a little bit about, you know, other things that I've sort of glossed over to get to this question. But to me, it was such an interesting thing to learn.
Yes. I mean, one thing that jumps to my mind was the big property rights case that the court decided at the end of the term, a case called Cedar Point, that really has not gotten much public attention. But it's exactly what you said. it was the culmination of a long project. Actually, it was Justice Scalia's project, and he died in 2016 with that project unfulfilled, and now it's been fulfilled. The question was, what amount of government regulation of the use of property requires under the what's known as the Takings Clause of the Fifth Amendment, where people may know government may not take property without, quote, just compensation. So when is the government required to compensate you for regulating your property? Until this term, the law had been, it wasn't an absolute, quote, taking, that's a term of art, taking, unless the government actually literally took, invaded your property by building something on it, taking away your use of it, whatever. A simple regulation was not a taking unless it was disproportional to your interest in the property. It had to be a kind of a weighing kind of analysis rather than an absolute.
Right. In other words, there are cases where it's absolute, eminent domain, they take it. But,
exactly.
But
exactly.
There are cases where the regulation alters its value to you, perhaps, and that becomes a cost-benefit analysis kind of thing.
Right. And the law had been, as long as the value is more than zero, it's not an absolute taking. We have to evaluate it within the full context of what's going on with the regulation, the purpose of the regulation, the value that's left, and so on. Okay. So this Cedar Point case was a challenge to a California labor law that dates to the days of the great Cesar Chavez. It said that a labor union had the right go on the farm for a short time before the workday or a short time after the workday. For quite a few days of the year, I forget exactly, I think like 180 days of the year, to organize the farm workers because they're not easily reachable elsewhere. You can't like send an email to an itinerant farm worker, so on. So the two growers challenged this as an absolute taking. And the court said, you know, you're right, it is. And that kind of breached the wall between an absolute taking and a regulatory taking. This may sound like kind of obscure stuff. I think people, this did not get identified as a big sort of A-level case, but it changed the status quo in a way that fulfilled the Scalia project. And so now we have all kinds of questions about the extent to which government can assert the right to go onto somebody's property for a regulatory reason, for a safety or health inspection or whatever. These are questions that the court didn't answer in that case, but questions that are raised and are sitting there awaiting the next case. So that's an example of an answer to your question about, you know, talk about a project and how the court kind of fills out the unfulfilled projects of its various members.
Yeah, and what I see there is that there's a that model that I sort of talked about step by step, and I'm gonna read something else. Although, and this will allow you to talk a little that we can shift from this question to the next one, which is the transition from a Roberts court to a whatever it is now, right? And you have written that although Roberts might want to get to the same place as his more conservative colleagues, Alito and Gorsuch, who seem to be much more impatient, quote, he saw the utility in planting seeds that could germinate and grow to gradually move the law so far down the road that the slightest touch could push it over the finish line and the end result would appear to the public as all but inevitable. And that's in some sense what happened in the Cedar Point, right? There had been little moves made, and then this one, suddenly reality is different.
Well, that's right. And it's going to happen this term.
Yep.
With a seed that Roberts planted a few terms ago and then, you know, watered lovingly in the term that I write about, which is religion.
Yep.
Particularly, specifically, the channeling of public resources into parochial schools. Mm-hmm. And Roberts and the court have been going down that road step by step. There's a case that's going to be argued in mid-December, a case from Maine that I'm virtually certain is going to result in removing any barrier that's left for the state to channel public money directly to pay tuition in religious schools. So the, you know, when you and I sort of came of age, there were raging battles about what used to be called parochial aid. And the answer had been, you know, you can subsidize the busing to parochial school. You can subsidize the secular textbooks that the schools use to fulfill the state's requirement for secular education. You can give what was called release time to let kids leave the public school and go get their religious education at their religious school. But you can't just send the money to the religious school for the religious part of the education. And that's what's at issue in this case from Maine. And I think that's what's going to be the result.
Okay, we sort of set up two things then. One that I referred to a few minutes ago, which is the shift from a Roberts court to its current incarnation. And then let's focus a bit more on religion, because I think that's one where you've cited the little steps that have been taken to bring us to the brink on that one. But let me tell people first, this is Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally, speaking today with Linda Greenhouse, Pulitzer Prize-winning Supreme Court reporter for The New York Times for 30 years. And we're talking about her latest book, Justice on the Brink, The Death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, The Rise of Amy Coney Barrett, 12 Months That Transformed the Supreme Court. And here's a couple of websites to learn more about Linda's work. One is law.yale.edu/Linda-Greenhouse. And the other one is nytimes.com/buy/Linda-Greenhouse. Okay, this Roberts had found himself in the center when Kennedy retired. And use that position, as you pointed out, that the term previous to this one, I think he was in the majority 96% of the time. He was able to moderate sort of the impatient, more aggressive right-wing colleagues. And suddenly, with the death of Ginsburg and the appointment of Barrett, that has changed. Talk a bit about that.
Yeah, so, you know, there's really an irony in Roberts' trajectory. So if you go back to 2016, he went on the court. He became Chief Justice in 2005. So he's been there for quite a long time
mm-hmm,
now.
Yeah.
2016, had Hillary Clinton been elected, as certainly most people expected, she would have filled the vacancy that Mitch McConnell would let Obama fill. Let's assume with somebody a good deal more liberal than Antonin Scalia, and Roberts would have been in the minority in his own court. The center of gravity would have shifted to five liberals headed by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, because she was the senior associate justice on the left-hand side of the court. That didn't happen. Roberts dodged a bullet when Trump was elected and puts the three justices on the court, which ironically leaves him not in control from the right, because he's got five people now to his right.
Right. Too much of a good thing.
Too much of a good thing. So, you know, that's not to say, and I want to make sure that people don't think I'm saying, that John Roberts is some kind of squishy moderate. He is not. He's a very, very conservative judge. He's the justice who wrote the Shelby County case.
That's right.
In 2013 that gutted the Voting Rights Act of 1965. I mean, he's got his projects, and they're very conservative. But, you know, his name is on the door. It's the Roberts Court. So I think he's a student of history. I think he cares a good deal about how his court is going to be seen by history. And so he is trying to rein in the kind of whippersnappers mm-hmm. To his right, the Sam Alitos, the Neil Gorsuches, And that's a tough job. And so, you know, what I ended up concluding is that this notion that there's always a center of the court, I mean, mathematically, that's true. Of course, when there's an odd number, there's got to be somebody in the middle. But there's not anybody in the middle right now that can control the court from the middle. It's emerging as a group of justices, and it's Roberts, and it's maybe Kavanaugh, maybe. It's maybe Amy Barrett, maybe. Who anybody framing or arguing a case to the court has got to peel a couple of them off if you're going to be something other than the far right in charge. It's a fascinating dynamic, and it's one that we haven't seen for a very long time.
Let's talk a bit about the pipeline that produced the three Trump appointees, and specifically, you go into some detail in Amy Coney Barrett's background. But I think this is something people don't know enough about.
Yeah, so people may remember the night that Scalia died, or the night that his death was known in February of 2016, candidate Trump came on and said, you know, I've got a list of 10 justices. If I'm elected, here's who I'm going to pick. And they had all been, and he acknowledged this, vetted by the Federalist Society, by this organization called the Federalist Society. In the book, I talk about its origins, by a group of kind of disaffected conservative law students at Yale and at the University of Chicago who felt that their points of view was not adequately reflected in the faculty or in the judiciary, in the higher reaches of the legal profession generally. And so the goal of the Federalist Society, which is very well funded by foundations on the right, is really to cultivate and grow the next generation of conservative lawyers and judges. And it's been very successful. It's been very lucky because, as you said at the top of the show, Republican presidents have been willing to play with this group. And Donald Trump named well over 200 judges to life tenured positions on the federal courts. And I believe all of them were cleared and served up to him by the Federalist Society. So that's what Kavanaugh and Gorsuch and Barrett, who are three quite different people, of course, I don't mean to say they're all the same, but what they have in common is they all played very well with the Federalist Society and got the Federalist Society's stamp of approval. In Amy Barrett's case, I mean, years ago, when she was coming off her Scalia clerkship and starting down a path for an academic career, she got an early fellowship and kind of was embraced by the Federalist Society and other conservative groups that kind of circle around the legal profession, and really propelled her into a position of prominence on the intellectual right within the kind of law world, you might say, as somebody in waiting to be, you know, picked up. She was one of Trump's early appointments to the appeals court. He put her on the Seventh Circuit, which is a appeals court in the Midwest based in Chicago. There had been a vacancy there that the Republican Senate had not allowed President Obama to fill. So it was ready and waiting for Amy Barrett. And, you know, kind of went on from there. And it's part of the reason why she was such an obvious choice, that Mitch McConnell could summon the president to the phone and say, she's the one.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and one of the things that many of the justices have in common, in addition to Federalist Society seal of approval, is Catholicism. And I bet to many people who don't follow the Supreme Court closely, you could win bets in a bar if you said, how many Catholics are there on the court? And is it six right now or seven?
Well, I count Neil Gorsuch, who currently is an Episcopalian.
But he was brought up Catholic.
brought up Catholic, and he went to the same Jesuit boys' school that Brett Kavanaugh went to.
Wow.
So the answer is 7. Justice Sonia Sotomayor also had a Catholic education.
Right, of course, yes.
But she's not on the bus the way the other six are. Yeah.
But why so many Catholics? I just have to ask that as someone who also was brought up Catholic.
Well, what I say in the
book. We remember, by the way, we remember when Kennedy's Catholicism in 1960 was a point against him.
Well, of course. And sometimes the court went for years without any Catholics on the court. During the Warren court years, I think Justice Brennan was the only one. So, you know, what I say in the book, and it's what I believe, although you can get argument going, is that for Republican presidents, and all these conservative Catholic judges were named by Republicans, mm-hmm. Catholicism has served as a proxy mm-hmm. for a justice who would be willing to vote to overturn Roe against Wade. And every president has run, well, of course, for Trump's candidacy, I can't quite say this because the Republican Party failed to even produce a platform in 2016 when they nominated him.
That's right.
But ever since Reagan, Republican presidential candidates have run on a platform that pledges them to appoint judges and justices who would affirm the right to life, right?
Right.
So, you know, the president cannot ask a potential judicial nominee, hey, would you overturn Roe? Can't ask that. And if he asked it, the potential nominee couldn't answer it. So that's the unasked and unanswered question. And so you nominate a conservative Catholic judge, and you hope that you get the answer that you want when push comes to shove.
Right. Right. By the way, one can say that every Republican platform has listed this, and that way, the fact that there wasn't a platform this last time.
Yeah, correct.
I want to end, I think, by continuing, by going deeper into this question about religion and the change of the onus and sort of where religion stands. But so that we don't get through, which we will in about 7 or 8 minutes, without talking about Roe v. Wade, first, your response to the court's letting stand the Texas anti-abortion law, and then I think December 1st, the arguments are heard in the Mississippi case.
Yeah, I mean, for the court to let the Texas law go into effect without bothering to get briefs and hear the argument was really shocking. I mean, I'm not surprised by all that much after all these years of following the court. I was truly surprised by that. And the reason I was so surprised is that it would have been so easy. It would have been so natural and normal mm-hmm. for the court to say, look, we're going to hear this Mississippi case in December. The question in the Mississippi case is, can a state ban abortion before the date of fetal viability? That's also the question in the Texas case, which bans abortion after roughly 6 weeks. And so since we're going to decide that question, rather than just let the Texas law go into effect without our supervision, just put it on hold and we'll take it under advisement when we decide what the law is that's going to govern the outcome of this case. That's what they normally do. I mean, it's very common. Because anything that's sort of bothering people in the country ends up as a Supreme Court case. So it's very common that more than one case at a time comes to the court raising a similar question. And the court will, you know, grant case number one, and case number 2, 3, and 4 get, you know, put aside and frozen in place until they decide how they want to handle that legal question. So it was just very shocking that they didn't do that.
But, as I said, arguments will be heard in just a couple of days on the Mississippi case. And that is the opportunity many on the right and probably many on the Supreme Court have been waiting for. What do you expect?
Well, certainly they're going to uphold the Mississippi law, or else they wouldn't have taken Mississippi's appeal, because the law is flatly unconstitutional. It was struck down by the most conservative federal appeals court in the country that had to strike it down because it's blatantly unconstitutional. So there was absolutely no reason for the court to take the appeal unless they wanted to change the constitutional law governing abortion.
That's right. And let me just say for people, this is one of the other things that Linda looks at and that you will learn in the book is things like that, that they wouldn't choose to take the case unless it fit a strategy they had. Those sorts of kind of behind the scenes thinking is a lot of what to me is the value in this book. So and when you say that it is unconstitutional, it is unconstitutional because of the decision in 73 in Roe versus Wade and the viability as the principal deciding point?
Yes, I mean, for almost 50 years now, and reaffirmed numerous times since then by the court, fetal viability has been the kind of firewall that has protected the right to abortion. The law as it now comes to us is states can put in all kinds of obstacles. They can make a woman, you know, walk on her hands and recite all kinds of nonsense and listen to untruthful so-called informed consent and all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, before viability, woman has an absolute right to terminate a pregnancy. Mississippi bans abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy, which is a couple of months before viability.
Texas only 6 weeks, which of course
Texas,
is way
weeks.
Before. Yeah.
Some states are thinking about, hey, why not no weeks?
Yeah.
So the question is if they, once they breach that viability wall, what's left? And, you know, the most common question that you hear in an oral argument, and as recently as a couple of weeks ago, one argument I was listening to, the justice will say to the lawyer, okay, what's your governing principle?
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, you know, if we buy what you're trying to sell us in this case, we're going to get the next case and the case after that. And what's the principle that's going to apply? What is the governing principle if they allow the 15 weeks and they breach the firewall? Why not 10? Why not 6? Why not none? And it's just very hard for me to see what is left of the actual right to terminate a pregnancy if that's the road they're going to go down.
And the other point you make is that the viability is a scientific, a medical determination. And it's clear that once we start going into viability isn't the point, then it's when does life emerge? Then it becomes part of moral, philosophical, religious thinking instead of something clear-cut like science or medicine.
Well, yes, although I mean I would modify what you said to say that it's always been, I mean, the argument against allowing abortion is founded in religion. You know, the only justice who was ever willing to call out the court on that was the great Justice John Paul Stevens,
mm-hmm.
who retired in 2009 and died 2 years ago at the age of 99. He was willing to do that. The rest of them, not so much. But at the heart of it, it is a matter of religious belief. And, you know, if that's somebody's belief, obviously they shouldn't have an abortion, but nor should they make the rules for the rest of us
that
don't happen to have that belief.
That's right. Let me we're into the religion piece now. And, you know, but under this court, to me, we're seeing a distortion of the meaning of religious liberty. To protect the right to discriminate against others based on religious preference rather than to protect the right to practice religion. Talk about that.
Yeah, so again, this is a longer project that came to a kind of a fruition in the term that I write about, although not fully, and it's a story still in progress, but what we've seen is a privileging of religious practice over any other claim, over claims of discrimination on the basis of disability, of age, LGBT. You know, it's hard to know exactly what the stopping point is going to be, but what But as a kind of a doctrinal matter, what the court managed to establish in this term that I write about was putting religion in what people call the most favored nation.
Yeah, I'm reminded of Animal Farm, where all animals are equal, but some are more equal. I mean, all rights are inalienable, but some are more inalienable.
That's right, that if any claim is given more attention than a religious claim, that's unconstitutional, and religion deserves, has to be treated as well as any other claim for any other reason. And that's really a change, because the Constitution protects not the, the First Amendment has two religion clauses, free exercise, which yes, we understand, and the Establishment Clause, which means that we cannot establish religion, either a certain faith or religion in general, to govern all of our other activities. And you know, I'm oversimplifying, obviously, but the trend line is clear that that's the way this court is going.
Yeah, and we've can you just mention for people a couple of the decisions that show us that shift?
Well, the main ones were a couple of cases where the court, once Amy Barrett came on the court, struck down capacity limitations on various places where people could gather for various reasons, including for worship.
Right, and this was pandemic related restrictions. And as I read it, they've had four cases: two before Ginsburg died, and two after Barrett was elevated. And when Ginsburg was on the court, the church did not get special treatment when it came to, as we said, the size of crowds and so on. And once Barrett was on the court, in those two cases, they did.
That's right. Over the dissenting vote of Chief Justice Roberts, who said, you know, we're not the public health experts. We as judges should defer to the public health experts. But instead, the court deferred to the churches. And that's where the term left us.
Okay, let me give you kind of a closing statement, sort of, which is that given what you observed, what you wrote about, and what we've embarked on a couple of weeks ago, which is this next term, what's the here's the lesson, or here's what to watch, whatever is your closing point here?
Well, I think what to watch really are the cases that will advance these long-running conservative projects. So we've talked about abortion. We haven't talked about guns, but the Second Amendment, big project, the New York gun case that was argued in early November, the religious schools case that's going to be argued later in December. All these go to the kind of, as you started the top of the show, there's been a long, decades-long effort to kind of get the courts in a position to make the policy that on the conservative side of the street they couldn't make through normal democratic processes. Mm-hmm. That's what's going on now. And I'm afraid that's what we're going to be seeing.
Let me tell you, the latest book, the one we've been talking about, is Justice on the Brink. And it's about the 12 months that transformed the Supreme Court, the term of 2021. The websites are law.yale.edu/Linda-Greenhouse and nytimes.com/buy/Linda-Greenhouse. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 10 or so articles to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts and most major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts there. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all to you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Linda Greenhouse. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Terry. Happy to talk to you.